Okay, we are just on 7:30, so I think we'll go ahead and get started. I'm going to mute all, and you will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you have a comment or a question, please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. And the deck, along with the contents of the chat window and the audio recording, will go up on the website probably later on this evening. And we have a pretty good agenda, and so, Alan, take it away.
Okay, thank you, Chris, and welcome, everyone. And we're going to start off with a couple of follow-ups. First of all, there was some discussion last week, I think, about auto updates for LibreOffice. And, of course, the answer is you have to switch to Linux because Linux has LibreOffice installed by default. And it turns out it's part of the regular operating system updates. And so you can see here that there's an update available. By default, it comes checked, ready to go. But you do have to press the install updates because in Linux, you can actually select which updates you want and which one, and you can disable ones that you don't want. And so you're in total control, as I've said before, of your update process. However, if you're stuck on Windows, there's still hope. And if you go to the tools icon in the menu and navigate down to options and online update, you find that there are checkboxes here for automatic updates, and you can set it for every day. And you can set it to download the updates automatically. However, that's still only part of the issue. It will download the updates automatically, but you still have to install them manually. So it's not a perfect solution, even for Windows users. Okay, and then the second item is talking about upgrades to Windows 10, and that's Chris.
Yeah, so at the Q&A on the first of the month, somebody talked about using Windows 7 and Chrome all of a sudden stopped working. And that was because Chrome, the last version of Chrome to work under Windows 7 was Chrome 109 released on January 10th. So after that, any automatic update to Chrome just wouldn't work. And there were a couple of options talked about, one of which was switching to a different browser that still supports Windows 7. And one option that wasn't mentioned was the idea that you can, for free, still upgrade to Windows 10. And so Ed Bott, who he has an ongoing article that he's had for years on how, yes, you can still get the free upgrade, and every now and then he checks to make sure that it still actually works. And as of the date of this article, which was, I can't see it, the end of December of 22, it still did work. So that would be an option for anybody who is on Windows 7 and all of a sudden you're having things like Chrome not working anymore. You can still do a free upgrade to Windows 10. And I pasted the link to that into the chat as well.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And just remind everybody that now, I think it was Stuart suggested that we should have what's happening now item on things that we've covered in the past. And so we've created this software update. And today we're going to hear about Microsoft Power Toys. And you know that Chris has been following this for, I think, a number of years. And you go to the index, you'll find there's a lot of presentations, mini presentations by him on new products, new programs that have been added to Power Toys, and today is no different.
Oh, here, I thought you were going to talk about Locksmith.
No.
Okay. So, new Power Toys. So, there's anybody who's unfamiliar with them, they are a really great set of utilities. They are still in pre-release. After many years, they're still not up to version 1, but they are a stable set of utilities that add some great functionality. As Alan alluded to, we've talked about it quite often at Q&A, and I've written in the newsletter about it. Well, version 0.68.0 got released on the first of the month, and I think they upgraded just within the last week or so. They upgraded to, I think it's 68.1 to fix some minor bugs that they thought were important to squash right away. And in that, there, beyond some new functionality and things like that, there are actually two brand new power toys, Paste as Plain Text and Mouse Jump. Next. So the Paste as Plain Text will allow you to take any formatted text that's on the clipboard and convert it to plain text. So this can be very useful when you're pasting information into a document or something like that, and you don't want the source formatting to come across with it. The default for it is the Windows Control V key, and that has the hotkeys in all of the power toys that can be customized to whatever you want. So there are a lot of programs that actually do have a function built into them that allows you to do the paste as plain text in essence. One of the things I like about this is that it standardizes against all your programs. So any program you happen to be in, you can use whatever the hotkey is, either the default, Windows Control V, or whatever you customize that to take whatever's on the clipboard, convert it to plain text, and paste it in. Note that it does convert what is on the clipboard, so you can't then go back and, you know, paste it in with formatting without going back to the source information and copying it to the clipboard again. So a very useful utility. The other one is Mouse Jump. I find this to be a little bit less useful. So say you're working in a document and you're looking up information on the web, you know, in one window, and your mouse pointer is way over on one side of the screen and you want it in your document, say in where the document title is. Next. So rather than scrolling your mouse across, you can actually just call up Mouse Jump, which by default is Windows Shift D, and you'll get a little window of your desktop centered around near where your mouse cursor currently is. Next. So then what you do is you click within that window where you want the mouse cursor to actually go to. So here I'm pointing to the title of the document in that little miniature window. Next. And then lo and behold, the mouse cursor will actually jump over to that other end of the screen. And the window, that little mini window, actually disappears at that point too. So I think that on a single screen, it's probably not all that useful. I don't find it all that useful. If you have multiple monitors spanning across a large distance, it might actually be more useful where you can go from one end of a virtual desktop to another end. Currently, it doesn't support actual virtual desktops. I've put in a suggestion for an enhancement on it that when you call it up, if you have virtual desktops in, that it would actually call them up as well, and you could click on one of those that it would then activate the virtual desktop and move the cursor to that position. I haven't heard back from anybody on the PowerToys team say whether they agree that it'd be a good idea or not. And yes, Windows 10 and 11, Bill, I assume you're talking about PowerToys. And yes, it'll run on Windows 10 and 11. And then getting to the power toys. So it is one installation. You install all of the power toys at once. If you don't want to use some of them, you can disable them, but they will all be installed as one place. And that's it.
No, it isn't. You've got several builds here, I think.
Oh, yeah, okay, that's just, yeah, how to get it. It's just basically you go to the Power Toys releases page. The most recent release will always be at the top. Scroll down to where it says assets, and make sure you don't scroll too far because they have multiple releases on that one page. And if you scroll down too far and go to the assets section, you'll end up jumping to some previous release. So just go to the first set of assets and then download the Power Toys setup, and then the version number, X64, rather than the, I forget what the other version is that you can install. But you want the X64 for Windows.
Looks like there's an ARM64 as well.
Yeah, ARM. Yeah, that's the other build that's available. And that's it.
Okay, that is it. Thanks, Chris. okay, so our next item is a question that came in. about selling things online. And the question was, which sites do people have experience with? And what's effective for what purpose? And how do you protect yourself if you want to sell online? And anything else that might be useful? So I posted this in the members only forum and a number of people replied. So I've made up some slides. I think everybody who replied is here tonight so they can talk to their own slides as we go along. So first up, we have Bill Van Dyke, who has an interesting story about how it used to be easy to get your money out of PayPal and then sometimes later it wasn't. You want to talk to this, Bill? You'll have to unmute your mic.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing. In the past, I've sold small items and I paid through PayPal and I got my money back through PayPal. No problem whatsoever. And then a few months ago, after not selling anything for quite a while, I had something and I sold it on eBay and, you know, we're talking about a couple hundred bucks. And all of a sudden I get a message after the sale is completed that I have to submit my banking information before they can pay out my money. I said, well, gee, they don't look at me, what the heck? So anyways, that was simple, you know. I figured I'll give them my banking information. Well, that didn't work at all. And there were a number of reasons. And the help desk was exceedingly unhelpful because what they could tell me is that, well, you did not enter the correct information as is required. Okay, well, fine, I can accept that. So tell me what it is that I have to change. We don't know. That's basically the answer. So we just kept trying one thing after another. So after a couple of weeks of frustration, we sort of came to do a couple of conclusions. That first of all, your name on eBay has to be exactly the same as it is on your bank account. And my eBay account was Bill, whereas my bank wants to go with the way my mother called me, was Willem. So that had to be changed. Okay, no problem. Still didn't work. Turned out that our account was also a joint account with my wife and I. All of our accounts over the 50 some years that we've been married have been joint accounts. Never been a problem. Not good for eBay. So I had to set up my own account specifically for eBay. At this point in time, had I known this beforehand, I would never have gone to sell anything there, but that is beside the point. I go to the bank, I send an email to the bank. And I set up an account and everything is good. Send them the information. Not good enough for them because the Ing Bank is what they call a virtual bank. What the eBay wants is a brick and mortar type of bank. So, okay, that didn't work. Go back again, set up an account with an official bank and it turns out that they need full authorization to that account. So that means that, you know, they can take whatever they want, yeah, before they can also deposit. So make a long story short, I now have a special account, which I never really wanted, only dedicated to eBay. So anyway, anybody thinking of selling on eBay, it is not a simple thing anymore. At least it seems to be. And I would say, you know, like, I mean, if you're going to do that, try to get your account set up before you actually sell something, because they will allow you to sell something and then tell you that you can't have your money. So I have no idea. I've asked them, so what is going to happen if I don't do this? Well, they, you know, said you agreed to all of our changes in the rules and all that kind of stuff. Well, I'm sure I did, you know, because they sent changes out every couple of weeks. So I'm sure there was one in there where I totally agreed with whatever they got warning from me. So anyways, that's all I can kind of tell you. It's now working. Okay? So, but I'm not happy about it.
Thanks, Bill. There's a question from Karen. What percentage does eBay take?
I did not calculate it out exactly, but it was fairly substantial. From the, I think, $215 that I got from my sale, I think I only got something like $176 or something in my bank account in the end.
Wow. Oh, that's horrendous. Okay, thank you. So moving along, we have Karen has been using a number of options, Facebook and Kijiji. So Karen?
Hello, everybody, and I'm just going to say how lovely it is to still have light at this time of day.
Where are you?
Okay, I'm in southerly North Gore.
I'm looking out the window and it's pretty dark.
Twilight here then, twilight here. So when Alan wrote, I don't have a tremendous amount of experience, but I have sold some products. And I have used Facebook Marketplace, Kijiji, and some Facebook local community pages. I also have several friends who are heavy users of Marketplace and have gotten the most unbelievable deals, both in a sell as well as a buy situation. So that seems to be a pretty good spot if you're comfortable with Facebook. I've had mixed experience where I've posted some stuff and get no hits, and then some experience where I do get hits, and the exchanges have been really quite excellent for the most part. But I am rural and we have a different way of doing things sometimes, so we tend to be quite easy to get along with, and is a fairly simple transaction. I did have one fellow that bought tires from me, and so he came with his gauges and all sorts of stuff, and then he tried to haggle with me. And I said, nope, the price is the price. And I thought you can either leave after having driven here or you can buy them for the price. So that's what he ended up doing. So there, sometimes you can have interesting interactions as well. And then there was a fellow that we did it where I had a product that it was a bed that I was housing for a friend that had moved. And another friend arranged to make the sale through Kijiji and have the fellow come to my house and pick it up. And then we arranged an e-transfer through the other friend. So it was a bit of a complicated one, and it still worked out quite well. So as far as sites, those are things that I have used. And while not really a sell site, I offer this as another option, that I really love the concept of the Buy Nothing Project. So there's in North Gore here where I live, there's a Buy Nothing Sell Nothing, where you just basically post and people can say, I'm interested and this is why you should give it to me. And so it basically keeps things out of the landfill. And I think it's just a wonderful way to have treasured items move to a new home rather than the landfill. So I mentioned that as an option, too, that people may not be aware of if you weren't necessarily committed to a sale and receiving remuneration for your product. All of the sales that I have done have been with a buyer picking them up at a set location. In some cases, that was at my home, and I just caution that I am a single woman, so I make sure that I have some security measures around at the time of that. Or if it's depending on the size of the item, we could meet at a mutually agreed public location and work that out. And the communications have often been through private messaging through Facebook or through Messenger so that we can take our conversations offline and not have everybody else see all of our back and forths and possibly reveal some private information as well. I always do cash or an e-transfer. I know people sometimes want to do other forms of payment, but I found that those two generally work quite well for people, and then the transactions complete immediately. When I'm doing an e-transfer, I always make sure that before the person leaves with the item or before I give them the item, that they're there, they can inspect the item, they can do whatever they want to do, but before I release the item, I make sure that the e-transfer is deposited into my account. And I think we can go to the next slide, Alan. One thing that I have used, so this was perhaps a great learning experience for me. I happen to be an enormous lover of Yorkshire Terriers. And my beloved Yorkshire Terrier died, and I finally got to the point where I thought that I could look at bringing a new member into the family. So I explored a variety of different options, and I found that breeders were out of my price range, so I looked at Kijiji. And when I did find a new beloved animal called Panda Bear, I went and saw Panda Bear, but my spidey senses were going off, and I should have listened to my spidey senses, and I did not. But I did have a contract in place with the owner at the time, and it turned out that the dog was not as advertised, and the dog ended up having kennel cough. So after great expense of taking this poor little 8-week thing to a vet and having a number of expenses to deal with the kennel cough, we tried to return the dog, and I used the contract that I had, and the woman was originally communicative, then ghosted me. So then I was contacting her via other methods, and we finally met the criteria that she required for us to do the return. But I thought, because of all of the interactions that I had, I wasn't really comfortable with how this was going to go, which is the slide that I'm now presenting, which is, you may or may not be aware of, the police's wonderful program called Keep the Peace. So because of my purchase, I was a bit concerned about how the return of the dog and the return of my money might go. I called in the police, and I had two cruisers and two police officers escort me to the home, and they basically just stand there and make sure that everybody stays civil and that the transaction occurs. And so the transaction escalated. So I was very glad to have the police there, because the woman went quite crazy and the police actually had to intervene. So in the end, I did get my money back. I was very grateful for the police's help in getting my transaction back. And I mention this because I think it's a wonderful program, which I have used, sadly, on a number of occasions. But I have found it quite beneficial, and I just rave about this program because it may or may not be available in your location. Police may or may not be available at the time that you require it, but each time I have used it, I have been grateful to have it there because they did have to intervene. And that's into me.
Thanks, Karen. Was that the City of Ottawa, ROPP?
I used the City of Ottawa.
Okay.
And another one was just for another interaction that I had. It was not related to any kind of a buy and sell, but it was another matter. And I've used it three times to deal with an unruly family member. And that was in southwestern Ontario, so it seems to be something that is across the board. And so in advance of my interaction, I call the police, ask them if they have this program and how it works, because each jurisdiction seems to be a little bit different in how they operate. Some like to have it booked in advance. Some want you to call just like a half hour ahead of when you need of it. So most departments seem to have some kind of a program like this. And again, I've used it probably on four occasions, and it's been incredibly helpful.
Okay, well, thanks very much. Right, so talking about buying nothing, Stuart has another option. Don't you, Stuart?
Unmute. Buy nothing sounds a lot like the old FreeCycle network I used to use when I was in Ottawa, which is pretty much the same thing. If you have something you want to get rid of without throwing it in the trash or burning it on the neighbor's lawn, you post a message on freecycle.org, and if anybody's interested, they'll come looking for it. And if you want something, you can post as well. Mind you, I haven't participated in that network for a long time. It may have evolved into this, buy nothing thing. Because I've been in Schwenningen now for 7 years, and there's nothing similar up this far north. Down in southern Quebec, the FreeCycle was active when I was there, but it's probably evolved into buy nothing by now.
I looked up on the web here, and there still is an Ottawa branch of FreeCycle, or a website for it anyway. Mm. And the URL is on the screen there.
Yeah.
And Serge Eric is saying that there's another similar thing called Nextdoor. And he's got the address, the URL on the website there in the chat window. Okay, thanks, Stuart. And moving along, Jeff has some thoughts on PayPal and associated credit cards.
Oh, hi. I am assuming I'm unmuted.
You're it.
Okay, great. The there's kind of a four... A four approach to, I've done more buying than I have selling. With selling, I've generally used Kijiji or Facebook Marketplace. The biggest problem with those two are no-shows when you're selling. People, I'll be there, and then they don't show up. That's sort of the bigger problem I've experienced. But in terms of buying, I look at it as a four step. Mostly it's in terms of protecting yourself. First of all, you would deal with the seller to try to resolve the issue. If you can't resolve it that way, then your option is to go to the platform. That each of the platforms generally offer some sort of resolution, be it through Amazon or be it through eBay. The third sort of step would be PayPal, which has a resolution center separate from the platform. So I tend to use PayPal whenever possible through these platforms. And, of course, I've never had to resort to the, fourth step which was anything was always resolved either on the platform or through PayPal, but various credit cards offer a certain amount of protection as well. The other thing I do for, protecting myself is I use an option MasterCard tied to my PayPal account. Now, I've got a couple of different credit cards, but the biggest problem is that they all tend to come with these exorbitant credit limits. Now, the reason I got this particular card was it was the only card that I could negotiate them for down to an extremely low credit limit. I got a remarkably low $300 on this card. There are instances where you can't use PayPal on the internet to buy something. And from reputable sites, the city of Ottawa, to buy a dog tag, you had to go through, I believe it was Moneris. So you will experience buying on the internet where you can't use PayPal. So I use this card. It has a $300 limit. So even if my information was hacked on a site, and as we know, sites get hacked all the time. And even if the credit card data was revealed, I could only be responsible up to a maximum of $300. This actually did happen. I don't know where the card was, where it was compromised, whether it was on the web or whether it was the RF tap, because I often use the card at Tim Hortons. But it all of a sudden, over a course of several hours, the card was maxed out with Food Dash, something in the Netherlands, like one of these skip the dishes type things. But it was like $10, $7, $12. And the list just went on to $300. Presumably, if you don't get instant notifications, you know, that would just keep going until they hit the credit limit. I did ask the card company why they didn't catch it fairly quickly. I never really got an answer to that. But they did reverse the charges, the downside being until it was reversed, I couldn't really use the card online because the limit was at its $300. But that would be about all I would think of protecting yourself. Again, four steps of resolution with the buyer first, the platform second, PayPal third, and your credit card company fourth.
Okay, thanks very much, Jeff, and thanks to Bill and Karen and Jeff for coming up with all those useful tips. Okay, next up we have...
Alan, may I make a general remark?
Sure, go ahead.
One of the things is, of course, now we've talked about different platforms of selling. What you have to keep in mind that you have different audiences on those platforms. For instance, my reason for going to eBay on these particular items is because they are of a rather specialized nature in electronics. And on my neighborhood type of audience, I am very unlikely to find a buyer. So when you decide on what platform to use, keep in mind what it is you're selling and what audience you want to reach. So that was just my comment on that.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Really good point. If you've got something which is fairly unusual, you have to have spread a fairly wide net to find a buyer. Okay, next up we have a share from Chris on Quick Assist.
So I've been using Quick Assist from Microsoft for quite a while. I find it to be a really good utility, easy to use and so forth for Windows 10 and Windows 11 users. And so the person providing assistance to somebody else, you can end up seeing the screen from the other person and see everything that's going on. And you could direct people to say, okay, go click on this icon. No, no, not that icon, this one. And, you know, see what the results are and so forth. And optionally, you can actually have the person, give you the ability to control their mouse and keyboard. So if you don't want to, you want to just show them what to do on their computer, that's entirely possible to do. And the a key thing is that the person who is receiving that assistance, they must approve the full control. It's not something that you can force upon them. Next. So remote control used to be part of the initial connection. So I couldn't get a screen grab on this because they've updated it, and none of the computers I have, they automatically updated to the new version. But it used to be when you were doing the initial connection, the person providing the assistance had an option to select. They wanted to do either view only or you wanted to have full control of the remote computer. Then the person who you were connecting to got a pop-up saying, you know, this person wants to have full control of your computer, or this person wants to just see what's on your screen, and they would have to allow it or not. And so that was all in that initial handshake. Next. So Now the way it works is the initial connection is always just in view-only mode. So the person who's offering assistance, they don't have that prompt that where they have to select whether they want full control or view-only mode. They are automatically going to be in view-only mode. And then the helper, the person giving assistance, is going to have a toolbar at the top of the quick assist window, as you see there. Next. And if you want to have full control, you click on the request control, and then next, the person you're helping will get a pop-up on the screen, or it's part of their toolbar, and it'll say the other person is requesting control, and they can either allow or deny it. So they can click on allow, and then all of a sudden, the person who's giving the assistance has the ability to control keyboard and mouse. Next. Now, the person who is receiving the assistance can cancel that control anytime. So if they see the person doing something like, whoa, I don't want them looking at that, or I don't want them doing that, they can click that icon in the toolbar for quick assist that says cancel control, and it'll immediately stop the other person. They'll be back into view-only mode. Or you can click on the leave button, which will cancel the whole session. Next. Now, this one, I'm not actually 100% sure whether this is true, that there are new capabilities on the toolbar. Again, I can't go back to the previous version. I never noticed this before, but certainly it's there now. So the person who is giving assistance, they can actually activate a laser pointer, which will, and they can select a color, and it's sort of like mouse trails, where it's a little bit easier to point and show where the mouse is moving. There's a chat box, where if you don't happen to be on the phone with the person while this remote session is going on, you can actually type messages back and forth. And there's a highlighter where you can highlight anything on the screen, and it'll stay there until you actually delete it or leave that particular function. Next. It turns out you may have to install Quick Assist from the Microsoft Store. Previously, it came bundled with Windows, and it was just a standard Win32 app. Then they changed it to be a Microsoft Store app, and depending on the version of Windows that you have, it may or may not be pre-installed as the Windows Store app. So it may be there. If it's not there, you just have to go to the Microsoft Store and do the installation of the program from there.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris. And by popular request, we have an item from Stuart, who's going to tell us about CBC Lite.
Hello. I'm back. Yeah, I found a great way to save bandwidth when I was trying to read the news on my mobile device. Skip the pictures. The CBC has got a website called the CBC Lite, and they don't use any graphics. You just get the text information. And you wouldn't believe what a difference it makes in your data usage. The first line of this slide says the National Enquirer, and it was only a few years ago that, well, everyone knew of the National Enquirer. It was sort of a joke around North America as the trashiest piece of publication anyone could ever hope to aspire to, because it was mostly lurid pictures of people in compromising positions or funny animals doing silly things, and gee, doesn't that sound like pretty much every major news publication on the planet today? Pictures of people and animals doing silly things. Yeah. There's even video websites set up for them. But you wouldn't believe how much bandwidth they take. So if you're on a mobile device and you want to just get information, not be distracted by silly pictures, the CBC's website can be set up to go to national is this one that in the slide here that Alan has. And I believe there's a global news light site, light site as well, as opposed to a dark site. Sorry, my mind's wandering. Anyway, news, all the news, and just the news. Save the pictures for TikTok. That's all I've got to say.
Yeah, you're thinking of the dark web, Stuart, aren't you? So this slide has the actual image of part of the CBC Lite webpage, and it's basically just text, as Stuart says. And there's the URL for the world news version of it. And Tom put in the chat that there's also, you can also use the reader mode in many browsers, which basically shows you the text and cuts out all of the adverts and images.
One of the things that I find a problem with reader mode is that typically you end up, the entire page has to load before you can invoke reader mode. And so you end up getting all of that wasted bandwidth and the crap on the screen. Then you can go to reader mode, which does make it easier to read your actual content, but it doesn't save you bandwidth.
Okay, moving along, I've got a share here on disk imaging. And you may recall a few weeks ago I talked about, or I mentioned that my favorite disk imaging program, which is Macrium Reflect Free Edition, is actually going to stop producing a free edition. So as of 2024, till the end of this year, we can still use it, but in next year, there'll be no support for the free version. And you know, I love free software, so I started looking around to see what else I might try. And in the past, I've used, because I use Linux a lot, I've used Clonezilla. Now, Clonezilla is an open source program. The problem I see with Clonezilla is it's kind of complicated. It has one of those old-fashioned text-based interfaces where you use tab and enter to navigate through various menu systems. But the main problem is it runs in kind of two different modes. It has a save disk mode where you can image and restore an entire disk, but you can't restore a single partition. Or you can use a save partitions type mode where you can restore individual partitions, one or more, but you can't restore the whole disk. So it's kind of an oddball system and not very easy to use. But then I found that there's a new kit on the block called RescueZilla. And this is basically a front end to the Clonezilla back end, if you like. It's kind of a neat little tool because it comes as an ISO file and you download it and create a bootable medium. I typically use a USB drive so I can reuse it if things don't work out. And you notice that the current version is called Jammy, and that should tell you that this is an Ubuntu Linux-based system. So basically, you're going to end up with a bootable USB drive, which comes up in Linux and effectively comes up in this screen, which is the RescueZilla app. And you can see it's pretty easy to figure out how to do things. You hit this button to back things up and you hit this button to restore things. There's a clone tool down here. But basically just backing up and restoring is fairly straightforward. So if we go to backup, then the first thing it wants us to do is choose a backup disk. So it basically goes and polls the disks on the system and gives you a list. And to some extent it gives this in kind of Linux speak, although it's pretty obvious here that here is my main SSD drive. This verbatim 8 gig is clearly a USB flash drive. I've got a 3.6 terabyte external USB drive, which I'm going to use for my backups. And I've got another small drive, which is actually an SD card. It basically says so over here, it's an SD card. So I can choose, I want to back up my Samsung SSD. Now it says, well, what partitions do you want to save? And by default, you'll notice that they're all checked. If I only want to save my Linux system, I could basically uncheck everything except for this guy down actually, yeah, this one down here, 58 gigabyte EXT4, which is a Linux file system. So that's my Linux drive. Anyway, I'm going to basically store image the whole drive. So the next thing it wants to know is, well, where do you want to stick this image? Well, I'm going to choose, I want my 3.6 terabyte external USB drive as my backup drive. And now it says, well, where on that drive do you want to put this thing? And now it's giving me, it wants me to put it in a mount backup mount point. So this is a Linux terminology, but it's basically a folder. Linux thinks of your whole file system on your computer is basically just one file system. So it has to know a mount point where to put it. And this mount backup is pointing to my 4 terabyte external drive. And now I can browse on that drive and I can navigate down through a Zimages folder and a RescueZilla folder. And you can see I've already got one image saved here. So I'm going to select this RescueZilla folder as the location for my new disk image backup. So now it's decided that, yes, we're going to use this folder as a storage location. And the final thing it asked me for is, well, what about a file name? And it by default suggests this file name. It's got the date embedded, and it's telling me it's a RescueZilla image. And personally, I'm happy with that. It's a unique name. I can figure out which backup is which from that. As an option, you can enter a description of the backup system that you're making. But again, I don't need that because I know that this is a full disk image. And then the final thing I think it wants to know is what kind of compression do you want? This is the default. It uses gzip, which is a zip type format in the Linux world. And you can set the level of compression. And you can turn off compression altogether if you want from this drop down menu here. There are various options. I just left it as the default. And then the final thing it says is, all right, this is what we're going to do. We're going to back up all these wonderful things, hit next, and off you go. And when the smoke clears, it tells you what happened. It saved all of these partitions, and it took just under an hour to do that. And when I go and look on my external USB drive, here's my RescueZilla folder in the Zimages folder, you can see now I have two image files which I've saved. So these are full backups of my hard drive on different dates. And if I look at one of those images in File Explorer, you can see that you've basically got, this is the image and this is what it contains. Got a whole raft of stuff here. Some of them are data files and text files. And then down here you can see that we've got an SDA5, which is a disk. So SDA5 is the Linux version of drive E or something. And we can see it's an NTFS partition. It's a part clone, so it's a partition. It's an image file. It's in gzip format. And you notice that there's an AA version, an AB, AC, AD, because it's basically splitting up the image for this one partition into 4 gigabyte slices. So this is because it thinks, well, it's kind of the good old days when you used to use DVDs to back things up, and you could only get 4 gigabytes on one DVD. So, but, you know, for you and I, it doesn't matter, because when we say restore, RescueZilla takes care of restoring all of this stuff without our intervention. Now, I point out one other feature here, which is like the browse feature in Macrium and ESUS to do backup, for example, where you can mount a partition from your backup image and then navigate through the file system and extract individual files and folders and copy them back to your hard drive. And you notice that this one is in beta format. But when you click on it, it gives you the option. You start navigating down, and I tell it, okay, I want to look at my SDA 7, which is an NTFS 16 gigabyte partition. This is my data drive. I want to look at that, and it says it's mounting it read-only, and then it tells me, and you probably can't read all this thing, but it basically says, for gzip compressed images, if you have large backups, and by large they mean more than 10 gigabytes, so not terribly large, it may take hours and it's unusably slow. And I can confirm that it is truly unusably slow. You would not want to recover any partition or any file from a partition using this format. So this is a work in progress. They're developing a new system to take care of this problem. But in the meantime, RescueZilla is actually a neat little tool for full disk image backups and recovery. Because you create a rescue disk, you create a bootable USB to both back the thing up and to restore. So it kind of guarantees that you're going to be able to see your images once you back them up. So I found it very useful, and I think I may actually move on to this. Anyway, time will tell. We'll see. In the meantime, Chris has a question that came in tonight, actually, and did a quick turnaround on error messages in Word.
Yeah, so Dennis sent this in, and he was signing into Outlook and got a message that in April, it said, most features of Word will be disabled. And so he's wondering, what does that really mean, and will Word still work? And the history behind this is that he bought a desktop back in 2020. It came with a 30-day free trial for Microsoft Office, but he was able to download Microsoft Office from Carleton University, where his wife is a professor. So that's the sort of history behind it. So I did a little bit of searching around on it, and it's likely, everything seems to point to it being a subscription that is expired, or you're no longer part of that subscription program. Now, Office 365, now Microsoft 365, is a yearly subscription. And so you can buy the suite outright, but I suspect that what you've got is either Office 365 or Microsoft 365 as part of a subscription. And if the subscription expires, I'm not exactly sure what really goes on when that happens. I couldn't tell for sure. Definitely we'll go into at least a reduced functionality mode. You may not be able to print or save or something like that. There's they want to convince you to renew your subscription. Now, if you are doing it on your own, so it's just that you're at the consumer level and you bought it either through the Microsoft store or at through a retail store or something like that, and you got a license key, and you end up that you have to create a Microsoft account with Microsoft, and then the subscription is attached to that. And then you can go to that account.microsoft.com, log in using that Microsoft account, and you can view the subscription status. So if you had gone and bought this, you could go there and you could see, oh, okay, my subscription is expiring, next month, and you can decide either you will renew it, give them more money, and they'll extend the end of subscription date, or you can decide, okay, I don't want it anymore. You just let it lapse, and then it goes into that mode of whatever it really means, that most features will be disabled. I presume it's going to be pretty unusable as a word processor. But the problem here, I think, is that it was obtained as part of a volume license. So if that's the case, then I think you're going to have to check with Carleton University to see why it got dropped, and how it can get extended. I know from administering a Microsoft 365 license center, what I've done is I go in and I add people to that by an email address. They can then install the software, activate it, and then it will just function. Now, it could mean that your email address was dropped from their subscription service somehow, or it could be somehow that the activation on your computer has gotten lost. But I think that the most likely thing that is going to help you here is going back to Carleton University and say you're getting this error message, and what can you do to fix it? And I suspect very strongly that they will have encountered this before, and they will be able to help you out.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And we're at the time, we're under the magic 10 minutes, so the last 10 for questions, and I noticed Harley asked, is 7-zip available for Linux? And the answer is I don't really know. Linux has a built-in archive manager, which seems to take care of all of these zip type files, and I've never had the need to look for anything else. So no doubt there are other apps which will handle zip files, etc., but personally I've never had to look for one. Jess asking, have I tried RescueZilla doing a bare metal install? He's thinking of changing a drive in a laptop with a solid state drive and doesn't want to have to reinstall everything. I guess I have, because I've done a complete image restore, which is essentially onto bare metal, if you like, and it worked perfectly. So I'm sure it works just fine.
Great, thanks, Alan.
Alan, this is Karen. I have a question. There was something that came up. I think it was by Bill, maybe, when he was talking about contracts, and I'm sure I agreed to some clause in one of the gazillion pages of things that we read. So this is probably a question for longer than what we have, but whenever we sign up for an app or a program, we have these user agreements that we have to look through, and the reams and reams of pages and pages. And I was just wondering if anybody had specific sections that they tended to look at in particular for content that may be of concern or not.
That's a great question. We should actually explore that one day. I think we've talked about that briefly at times. There used to be an app which would kind of review the thing for you and throw up all the flags. And there's also a website called Terms of Service Not Read. And it gives you the highlights of all these EULAs from a number of different packages. Anyway, somebody's trying to cut in there. Carry on.
Be quiet, Alan. Give your voice a break. A very important thing to check in all these EULAs is the country where any litigation will be settled regarding disputes. Because whatever company that you're agreeing to do business with has got to be based somewhere, and they usually have a court system wherever they are that they use. So that might be Bulgaria, it might be New York, it might be California, could be Azerbaijan. It's a world wide web.
That's good points, Stu, and I've seen lots through based out of Ireland, for instance.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Half the United States is based in Ireland right now.
So would that, what would be your yay or nay depending on that country?
Well, I can't say, but I'm just saying you might want to find out which country it is and then start digging into what's going on with that country at the moment.
Okay, thanks. Because there are pages and pages and clause after clause, right. And that you kind of scan them, but at some point you can't truly absorb everything that's there. And as I think it was Bill, that you don't know what you're agreeing to and what you're signing your life away for or allowing them to do or not do.
There's a rather famous example of somebody who wrote an EULA that on page 17 or something said the first 100 people who send an email to the following email address will get $100. And it took something like 3 months before somebody actually claimed the $100. So yeah, people, they were just trying to prove the point that people don't read these.
Okay, any other questions or comments, anyone?
Don't see anything new in here other than Natalie mentions that Microsoft Office Home and Student has a one-time fee, so the perpetual license. It's only for one computer, and it can't be transferred to a different computer, I believe, as well, to another restriction on it. My comment back on that was just that, yeah, there are a few options for perpetual licenses, but you have to do the arithmetic to decide what's the better deal. If you have multiple computers, almost always Microsoft 365 subscription is going to be the better deal. But single computer, you may find, and especially if you don't always want to upgrade to the latest, greatest version, that it might be a better deal for you.
Okay, thanks.
And Alan and Chris, this is Karen again, just to see one of Bob's comments about police presence may escalate a situation. Yeah, absolutely. So you pick and choose because you don't want to waste anybody's time and you don't want to take a situation to a state that it doesn't need to exist.
Okay, so I'm going to start wrapping up here and see if anybody's got anything else in the chat window later. We're talking about sales and deals. We have a deal, and I didn't look to see carefully if there are any new people here tonight, but is anybody who wants to become a member of the club or knows somebody who would thinks they'd like to join the club, if they join before the end of this month and give us $20, which is the regular annual membership fee, we will give you an extra year absolutely free. So it's a buy one, get one free, a BOGO offer. So think about that if you're interested in joining the club. Two for one, essentially. In April, our monthly meeting is all about the bits. And Stefan Richard is going to be talking about all those zeros and ones that go into computing. So look for that on April the 12th. The following month, as Chris alluded to, is May the 10th. That will be our members' favorites night. And this is just a warning, as Chris alluded to, if you don't put your name in here, then you may end up having to listen to Chris and I for an hour as we rabbit on about all things Windows and Linux and Android and anything else. So your only way out is to put your name right here. So send us an email, tell us what you want to talk about, and we will create a list of presentation slots for the May 10th meeting. And looking even further ahead, we're actually looking for a topic and a speaker for December. The monthly meeting program, all the slots are filled essentially, except for December this year. So we're looking for a topic and or a speaker. And so if you can help with either of those, then again, let us know and we'll see what we can do. And by the way, I think we mentioned last time that the board is actually one person short right now and we're looking for somebody who would take on the meeting program. So since you only have one slot to fill this year, it's not a terribly onerous job at the moment. So if you're interested in joining the board, let us know. And then finally, our question and answer session next week, March the 22nd. As usual, send your questions and topics. And now send us your members' favorites as well and your suggestions for December. And anything you want to tell us about computers, or you want to know about computers, send us a note and we'll see what we can do. So that's it for me for tonight. I hope everybody enjoyed it. Thank you very much to everybody who participated tonight. It was great to have a lot more people taking part.
Yep. Thanks a lot, folks. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.